This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. They offer just about every battery under the sun, from car and truck batteries to batteries for your trail cameras and rangefinders. Select retail locations even offer cell phone repair and cracked screen repair. Find a local retail location at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, guys. Welcome back to another Land and Legacy Podcast. We're doing another conference call via online chat room here. And so Adam's here.
Matt's here.
And Matt's coming in from an hour away as you've moved in. You're home, and I'm still up here in the suburbs, in the burbs. And for some of you guys, we may drop this. I don't know. We may drop this on our YouTube channel so you guys can see. But this is going to be another one of our This Does Not Equal That podcast series, where we compare various landscapes and places that we've worked and kind of try to debunk a lot of the myths with what you may see or what you may hear about these certain landscape or habitat features or plant communities that we find throughout much of the United States.
It may seem like a constant reminder to you and I, Adam, and maybe those who listen so loyally to the podcast, but details really matter. And I think that for so many years now, we've been taught that, you know, it doesn't really matter necessarily what's growing. There's so much growing out on the landscape that during the summer months, everything's green, it's good, food's not limited, there's cover everywhere, right? Well, that's not the case. And so these types of podcasts are really, really good because we can get super specific on what's growing within these pictures, identify and give you guys real, real clear direction to what something is and what it's not. And this is another fantastic example of two clearly different landscapes, but honestly, a lot of people probably would think that they're semi-equal in value on a close glance because there's a lot of greenery in these photos.
Yeah, totally. You know, Chad and I have been talking a lot as we're working on the farm a good amount over the last few weeks. And, you know, the Ozarks right now is an absolute jungle. Yeah. I mean, it is a jungle. It is green as a gourd. There's vines and weeds and all kinds of stuff growing everywhere very quickly. And, you know, you can mistake that as going, oh, yeah, my place is thick. And then December 1st, it is, I mean, the surf might as well be the surface of the moon, just very little cover quality. And, you know, probably a lot of it goes back to deer hunters are ingrained to explore their properties a lot during late winter, early spring and summer, and then stay out of them other than hunting during the fall and winter. And so we're seeing only the fringes usually. If they're a deer hunter that really explores their entire property through the fall, as in walking, they're probably not as far enough into habitat recognition or quality habitat recognition to understand what they may be lacking, because they haven't even figured out the hunting side of the game really to improve their success if they're intruding and being that aggressive in their hunting approach. But you know, you think about it, riparian areas a lot. Man, you go in a riparian area right now, you're going to see in the Midwest, just for example, you're going to see wing stem, wild golden glow,
giant ragweed,
Canadian wild rye, Virginia wild rye, river oats, all this stuff that if even just a smidge of sunlight, it just is neck high. And you think, holy cow, I got some cover down here. But if you were to go back into that area in mid-December, you'd be like, whoa, this is what happened. And then I think when people walk during shed hunting, they're not really paying attention to the thickness because it's all covered in snow. It's like, oh, whatever. But that's when you can really key in on quality cover, if you're walking during the snow when everything else is flattened and you can find areas where you're like, whoa, this is still really thick. If it's really thick with a foot of snow on the ground, it is a thick area.
Yeah, no doubt. We often get asked a lot as we're corresponding with potential clients, you know, what's the best time of the year to come and see a property? And I always like rethink that, I feel like. But what, as everyone knows, we're consulting 8 to 10 months out of the year. So we're coming at any point, but there is this window of like, I really like to see that property in February, March timeframe, weather, travel permitting, and time, because you really see the property bare bones, kind of worst condition of, does it even offer cover? But you and I, we're out in there so much that, okay, well, yeah, we know vegetation. Yeah. Species. What is it? What is this site going to look like in December? I know what it's going to look like, but some of these landscapes are so drastic, so night and day, black and white from one season to the next, that again, without having that prior knowledge or multiple years on a given property to see those seasons and changes, a landowner may overlook or think that a property has way more cover than what it does. And that couldn't be further from the truth in a lot of places.
I've gotten to where I tell people, the best time for us to get there is whenever you can get me there and whenever I have the time to get there. Whether it's July, August, or September, time is so limited. And if we're going to wait until ideal January, February, it's like, well, we're just going to sit on our hands for 8 months. Like, I'm just like, let's do it now. So going into the fall, you already have an idea of things to do. We can be ahead of the curve, like going into fall, like especially July and August is like, you know, there's some things we could do, even cutting in some bedding areas or edge feathering, or then spraying in October and November, depending on where you're at. It's like, if we had waited until January, February, there's some things that we might have to wait another 8 months to implement. It's yeah, like, let's just get it done.
Windows and time frames that that you can key into. And is there a bad time to see your property? Well, we don't think so. It's just a matter of, okay, timing. But yeah, we totally don't limit ourselves to the dormant.
Unless you're trying to get us there in early November, and good luck. Yeah. Man, and so another thing too, you mentioned is about the details, and it kind of triggered a thought in my head is like, we've got some clients doing some really amazing work. And I think we have people that aren't even clients of ours that send us messages that are doing amazing work. And even on my own farm, we're doing some amazing work. But there are certain details that, like, as we go through some of these pictures and we'll explain, is like, if all we did was that, we would be really, really awesome. But if we did some minor detail tweaks, added a few things, took away a few things, cut a few things, just a few little details. Overall, it's very small lifting stuff. The heavy lifting is removing whatever or doing whatever we may suggest. But those few little tweaks can make it, instead of a 7, a 9.5 or close to a 10 because we did those details. And man, how many times do we see somebody on social media doing straight hinge cutting? It's like, the goal was great. We're accomplishing a lot. I'm sure they saw improved deer activity, but they forgot some of the details that would make that even better.
There's, we often use that phrase 80 grit management and then 220 grit.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to say about that. The details really matter, or the 220 grit really matters once you've done the 80 grit. But if you're trying just to go and do the 220, the details, they don't matter because nothing else is even present for that detail to matter. And and it's, I like doing detail work. I think it's fun to really take that close observation, be very critical of stuff. As we're going to be here in this podcast with these two photos, but it doesn't matter doing 220 if you don't have the foundation built first and foremost. So that's why these two photos, basically, you're going to see photo one is a total 80 grit management, and then photo two, we're going to be talking about the high level details from this stage on what we're seeing. Let's 220 it and get really detailed because the base is already present.
It's funny you say you like the detail side because I almost hate the detail side. I'm like,
I like both of it.
It's like, well, I know we both like both sides of it, but I'm like, I don't even, I most conversations are 220 grit and higher when we should be talking sometimes 80 grit and lower.
For sure. I guess what I'm saying, I don't like 220 grit, of course, when 80 is necessary. But there's times once you've done so much work and put in the labor, it's like, oh, I just like adding that little cherry. It's almost like the christening of that habitat. It's like, okay, now it's done. Now I can walk away. It's a job well done. And I feel like, okay, it's I just got to follow up with the prescribed fire. Then I'm done.
I look at it like, 80 grit, if all a person did was 80 grit, the place would change drastically.
Crazy.
They might not get those few little tweaks to really key in on specific bedding, specific travel corridors. But if they have time and they play it smart, they're still going to kill them at the 80 grit management farm. But it might take the 220 grit to really key it in to where you're like, For me, and you'll hear me say this so much in the future, is like, we're setting up our farm that Chad and I purchased in February to be one of those where it's like, I don't have to scout every year. I don't want to scout every year. If I'm bouncing around 5 years from now, still moving stands, really, how well am I learning this property? I should have like destination stands or stands that are set up, and they're going to be in that same spot given a lightning strike, tree die, but they're going to be in that same area forever because it's a good area by design, and I don't have to go around chasing acorn trees or chasing oak trees, scouting, going, well, this is where the deer are at today. Why? Like that, if I honestly, and listen to the other podcast this week, because we'll talk a little bit about some of the stuff we're working on, but that's where the detail side of it can really come into play of going, okay, I'm working this farm and I don't want to be chasing my tail 5 years from now. And that tail being where the deer are going, where they're bedding. I'm going to set up destination bedding. I'm going to set up destination feeding. I'm going to set up bottlenecks in between. And I don't have to worry about learning new sets every year, trying to figure out what the deer are doing. I'm designing my farm to make the deer do what I know they already want to do, but really define it and make it to where I don't have to put a lot of thought into what they're doing at a certain time of the year.
Well, we're getting into a whole nother podcast that I would love to just take that thought and run with it, because we're on the exact same page, but I'm going to hold off because we get way into the weeds.
That's already in my,
but
I'm already in my notes for a future podcast.
Yeah. Because, no more e-scouting, no more summer this. There's a time and a window where I could bank on I'm going to that stand and I know the resources that are going to be available, and that's what I'm hunting at that time frame, and deer are doing this because the resource or the topography is there, and bar none, that's what I'm hunting, that's how I'm hunting, done.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we all got other things going on in life.
Yeah, we can, as a hunter, I think everyone listening can totally find themselves in this boat. But when it comes to trying to pick and hunt and scout and do this, we can very easily and quickly complicate things and overthink them. But it doesn't have to be like that, because really, we're hunting a very simple-minded animal. There's not many things that really they do that's just so haphazard.
Yeah. In my,
when, I guess I should say this, when a farm is set up appropriately.
Yep. No doubt. You want to see kind of like annual hunting patterns where it's like, I'm not moving stands around. I'm not moving blinds around. I'm just like, you know, it's September 15th. Deer's on this side of the farm. He's likely in that bedding area. He showed up on that camera. Or I have a hunch that there's that white oak on the edge of the food plot that's dropping acorns. I'm going to slip in there knowing I have a really good chance.
I just need, just give me the area that he's in there. And okay, from all the other knowledge of the resources that are there, I'll figure out a way to try and get in there. If it's accessible.
Yeah. And if he's moving during daylight, I've got a shot. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So jumping into
I was just going to jump right in back into the photos. Photos. Let's go to photo number one there. And this is a cool site, a really fantastic farm from the Bear Roots side of things. It's got a lot to build off of, but it's located in southern Iowa. And the portion of this podcast, this is not equal to that. We're talking about old fields. And that term old fields, people have so many different things that run through their head of maybe things that you hunted when you were younger, or bird hunted, or it's just a pasture field that's unmaintained, or it's a very nice manicured early successional field that you're going to see later on. But there's a wide spectrum of what people envision when you hear the term old field. And so that's what we're going to cover today. So number one photo is southern Iowa. You're looking out across an area that has been maintained, a ridge top. I say maintained by plucking and removing some hedge trees that have grown up in it, but largely is a base of smooth broom, buckbrush, and you can see a little bit of Indian grass popping through. And the field then is, as you're moving off the slope, off onto the slopes from the ridgetop, surrounded by eastern red cedar. And Adam, how many people do you think would look at photo number one and say, yep, that's an old field?
Oh, yeah. You see it all a lot. And we see it a lot on the real estate side of, you know, even just listings of saying, former cattle farm, now a great recreational, grows big deer because of the brush. And it's like, well, out of all the brush, I don't know if coralberry ranks very high on my list.
No.
The other common name is buckbrush. Coralberry, same thing. And you know, a lot of guys in the Midwest are gonna recognize it. Honeysuckle family can get pretty aggressive, even though it is native. And you see it a lot in overgrazed pastures, mismanaged pastures, pastures that have turned idle, fence rows. I mean, you can see it in a lot of places, especially places that have not had fire as well.
It gets spread a lot because it's got little tiny berries that birds are foraging on, and then you'll see it start up on fence rows under big trees, and then at that point it gets spread throughout the entire pastures. But tiny little cluster of purple, pinkish type berries. But man, they are, it's widespread in a lot of places. Yeah. We see that really in a lot of places that we travel.
Yeah. I think, if we want to real quick say, this is not deer forage out here. Very little forage. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give this a 2. Because I'm sure there's some brambles mixed in there somewhere. On a scale of 1 to 10 for cover, I'd give it a 3 because I see a few clumps of stuff. There is some native grass mixed in, but it's not very high on anybody's scale. It shouldn't be on anybody's scale. For turkeys, terrible. For quail, terrible. You could say, well, the buckbrush is good for the quail, but there's smooth broom all underneath it. So If we're trying to grow quail on this, I hope you're prepared for extinction because it ain't happening here.
I would if there was no smooth broom, I would give a much higher value to things like quail and wild turkey. There's some buckbrush, obviously scattered some holes, but if there was light, it's smooth broom. So it's almost like that double whammy, like, oh gosh, even if it was trying to be something good, like the understory is just chock full thick. And what I like about this photo for everyone who's following along, either go, I guess we didn't mention that. Go to social media if you're listening to the podcast, the photos will be there. Or if you're watching the video, obviously they're there on your screen. But you can see a mowed trail and how that mowed trail then blends right into the edge. So you have a height judgment right there easily. And you can see exactly how thick it is too. It's almost like if you are a turkey poult or if you are a quail of any size, it's an impenetrable wall that you'd be walking to from that mowed portion right into the smooth broom. And so it's just 100% unusable for those species or a poult, turkey poult, that is young and cannot get through there. And then even at that point, that buck brush is 2 foot tall. An adult turkey would have not trouble, but it wouldn't be found in there often.
No.
In my opinion.
Maybe some nesting. You might see a little turkey nesting a little bit, like right here on the edge.
I would expect them on the edge of some of this, but whew. It's
fawning. I wouldn't be surprised to see some fawns out in that at all. That would certainly be something you could see fawning. But as soon as the fawn gets of age to start foraging, it better pack its bags because it's not going to forage around there very much.
No, and that's again the most common misconception when it comes to, okay, it's green, so there's got to be something in there to eat. But if you're saying those things to yourself, there's got to be something in there to eat, and it's not wildly apparent, then that site is likely mismanaged. This is literally an abandoned field. It's not managed whatsoever for wildlife. Yeah. It happens to find itself and be on a recreational farm, but right now the current management strategy is don't touch it. Minus some of the hedge trees, which with this landowner, they just knew that, okay, I don't want hedge apples everywhere. I could make it a food plot, but I don't know if I should. Should I make it old field? Should I go back and it has the ability, just to the left of the screen, it's a tillable ag field. Like, should I farm it? Just unsure of what to do. Yeah. And if you find yourself in that position, I can understand keeping it idle for a year or two, but this is going on for a while. And so now we need to manage it. Now we need to take the right steps moving forward to offer, not question, well, they can find something in there to eat. It should be food and cover. And this is the awesome thing. You can turn that abandoned field into an old field so fast. It's honestly mind-blowing that it can happen in a matter of 3 months, 4 months.
Yeah.
You can be like a zero to hero kind of situation from a wildlife perspective. Those acres right there can be great. And the other thing I think that's important to mention is, one, how we would do that, but two, I mentioned earlier that they have the option of doing, you know, turn this into tillable, they could do it to a food plot, but what the suggestion is, let's do old field. And the reason behind that is likely based on this region, based on some land use, knowing that was old pasture and its relation to the Midwest, part of this was probably prairie. We're seeing Indian grass pop through, and we have experience, other clients have experience in this region of removing pastures that look just like this and turning into old field, and some just incredible responses from plant communities, seed bank, root stocks that are just incredible for wildlife. That
no do doubt. All
food cover, insect life, burn rotation, shrubs. I mean, it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Head turning, whoa. So it's a no-brainer to remove the smooth brome and get this puppy on a burn rotation, try and reduce some of that coral berry so it doesn't take over. It's a huge, let's say, composition within that stand of old field. So Adam, if you saw this site, how would you recommend the landowner to manage this and convert it from an abandoned field into an old field?
Yeah, what I would say is, if I had seen this place in, let's just say, January, February, because that's our typical window, or even early March, I would say, we're going to come in here. Looks like there's a decent amount of brome, you know, depending on thatch layers. I may say, let's give an aerial treatment of glyphosate. So get a UTV with a boomless sprayer on it, spraying a 30-foot swath, spray this field and kill that smooth brome. It most likely is 90% of the vegetation that's growing during that time of the year. So maybe 95%. So I can spray that whole area with glyphosate, kill back that smooth brome, and then give it a month as that smooth brome dies. And during that window of time, the buck brush is starting to really push up nutrients. I believe it looks like multiflora rose right out there in the middle of it. Probably autumn olive or bush honeysuckle coming on early. And if I send a fire through there a month later or in mid-April, I'm going to top kill that buck brush. I'm going to knock back the other invasives like the multiflora rose, and I'm going to release that seed bank and maybe even kind of get a really give that native grass a chance to blow out of there and not have all the competition. And I may only have to then use prescribed fire every 2 to 3 years and kind of set that back. And over time, I'm hopeful that my natives will outcompete and really come on strong. If not, I may have to do some spot treatments of herbicide to kill the buck brush or the coralberry. But I honestly, based on my experience, feel like I can weed it out pretty drastically with just appropriately timed fire. And that being in that, you know, out of the gate, I want to hit it with some dormant season fires. So pretty much everything, all the natives are going to be still mostly dormant, especially since this is an upland site. Those native grasses are going to be dormant or just starting to pop, and I can send a fire through and not hurt them, actually help them. And I can set that coral berry back as well as a multiflora rose because it's pushing nutrients. It's sending a lot of it up to the top, and I hit it back, and it's like, ugh. It's like walking through the desert for 40 days and thinking, okay, you know, I'm going to make it. And then all of a sudden you get hit back and realize you're going to have to spend 40 years there. And you're like, I don't know if I have the endurance for this. It's sent all its nutrients up and you hit it with fire. It's not going to produce much that same growing season.
Yeah. And you're talking about fire and following that up after herbicide application of the smooth brome and
about another. A month, yeah.
And yeah. That's, and
if you do it too early, I don't feel you get a true, like if you did it in 2 weeks when it's all starting to, let's just say it's really dry and it's only been 2 weeks. In my experience, I don't think you get the quality of kill because not all the roots have, that herbicide has not been fully taken up and killed the entire rootstock. It's, I think you're going to have some very patchy.
Smooth brome, fescue, they're very vigorous plants. And so, yeah, like you're saying, if it looks dead on top after a week and a half or 2 weeks, don't just go drop a match. There's a lot of still mobilization of herbicide getting to root systems. It might be showing suffering, those signs up top, but it still could be have enough activity down below. And so you want to make sure that all the herbicide has gone to the root system before burning it off. But it is important. Is it 100% necessary? No, but it is important, in my opinion, for the best growth and response after spraying it is to burn. I know there's states out there where it can be difficult to burn, but you said, hey, I can do old field. And in a picture like this, you're seeing 18-inch tall smooth brome. When that all lays over after being sprayed, that's a really heavy, thick mat layer of grasses that even natives are starting to pop through later in the summer and growing season, that it would be difficult for that to happen. Will that decompose over time? Yes, of course, but a fire would consume that thatch in a matter of minutes and allow basically a full growing season, nothing impeding that growth of the natives that we want. And photo number two, you're going to see exactly that process and that happen. So if you can get a fire, really highly encourage you to do that after the herbicide has really taken itself down to the root system, totally killed that smooth brome.
Yeah, I mean, if you do that in February and burn in, I get, or spray in February, burn in April, early April, I mean, shoot some turkeys over it, have some fun. Watch some broods be carried through there. But then ultimately prepare to be amazed come June and July because it's going to look totally different. Following that up, the next dormant season, I'd like to see some shrubs planted out through there to really take that to the next step. And honestly, what I'd probably do is find some of those trees around, hedge trees, and cut them, drag them out in the middle, and then plant the shrubs in those treetops rather than have to put tubes and cages and all that nonsense to try to get those things to grow. I'd rather just plant a bunch of bare roots seedlings right in a treetop of a hedge or any kind of tree other than I wouldn't like to use a big green cedar, but if
you're gonna have much of a bare root that next fire that goes through there.
Yeah. And so then I do that and you're gonna ask, well, what about fire in 3 years? I would mow and maybe lightly disc around those little shrub pockets. And then once I've lit my backing fire. I may drop out there and light a little bit around those shrubs so it burns off of them really slow, and I don't scream a head fire through it. So ultimately, that's going to be the management for me, is and then spot treating invasives. And then if coral berry is still not being suppressed, I'm really be shocked if it wasn't with the fire at the appropriate time. Because one thing I didn't mention is once you start getting a good base of, let's say, ending grass and stuff coming in, and you catch a good hot, dry August, I'd probably send a growing season fire through there to really set that buck brush back and promote more herbaceous forbs, or herbaceous plants like forbs. And that would ultimately, I feel, really, really, I mean, at that point, if you're still seeing buck brush to this degree, which you wouldn't, I would say then we'll talk herbicide.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I think a lot of people's resort is go straight to herbicide, and if, and let's just say in this picture you took all this, the smooth brome away, and you replaced it with great annual perennial weed bases, heavy forbs, and you still had that much buck brush, man, you would be killing out so many forbs trying to kill the buck brush with herbicide. It's like, yeah, no, we've got a better way to do it that's actually going to do the reduction that we want, but then replace it with forbs. So yeah, you don't want to just jump right into herbicide, even if you're more comfortable going that route versus a growing season fire, because the result is not the same. You're going to have more collateral damage with herbicide, being a broadleaf, it's not selective, than going with a growing season fire on a site like this if you're dealing with buck brush problems after removing smooth brome,
yeah,
and a initial fire. But this site, though, I mean, I don't want people to think that this is a bad site, because in our eyes, we totally see potential. This is fantastic. In the making, 2 years from now, this is going to be wildly different. Wildly different.
Yeah. Let's see picture number two.
Picture number two for
guys that are tuning in on a podcast, typical place. I guess Matt and I are assuming guys are watching this online, but for you guys that are listening, we're switching over and kind of seeing a post treatment here. So Matt, explain what we got going on.
So this photo takes us to South Central Ohio. Excuse me, Southwestern Ohio. This picture was just sent, I mean, we're talking a matter of a couple days ago, from clients who implemented essentially what we just talked about, the prescription, a couple minutes ago. So this site, I visited it in March. I visited in March. And this was nearly all fescue. This whole portion of the farm, the ridge tops and slopes, 80% of them were dominated with tall fescue, which essentially is the equivalent of smooth brome in a different region of the country. Still non-native cool season grass, pasture type grasses, and they've gone in and sprayed that grass, got it removed, burned the thatch off, and now this is their plant response in the middle of June. And so from a this does not equal that, Adam, what are you seeing in this photo?
I see a lot of common ragweed. I think I see some milkweed.
There was a lot of milkweed on this site.
I think I see some bull nettle, which isn't shocking to be growing. And then I can't tell what this tall stuff is to the left of the screen, maybe pokeweed.
Looks like it's got a pointier leaf to me that looks – because there's some left.
I hope it's not teasel.
Pretty positive it's not.
And then what's this to the right over in a corner? It kind of looks like a Maximilian sunflower, but
kind of what it looks like to me too. I can't clearly identify it from this photo, but.
And you did a before and after too a few days ago on our social media, so you wouldn't have to look too hard on Facebook or Instagram to see what this site looked like in March or whenever they sprayed it, or a couple weeks after they sprayed it, looks pretty barren. But I see a good diversity of plants. I see, you know, the big tree in the middle. So I'm not seeing a lot of woody encroachment, not seeing a lot of shrubs. I'm seeing mainly herbaceous plants, a few sprigs of grass, but mainly a herbaceous base. So when I see this, and especially, was this burned, Matt, or was it just sprayed?
No, this was, most of it was burned, is what I was told. But I see some what looks like some dead thatch, so maybe portions of this didn't burn.
I'd say as well. My gut would say this was not burned. This has just been sprayed because of the amount of woody stems you see standing. So I would, I'd say decent brood rearing. If it had been burned, it would have been way better brood rearing. Phenomenal fawning habitat out here, especially in the right and the left around these little clumps. Lots of food. Fawn can hide in that. An adult deer can hide in this, especially later in the summer as this common ragweed and milkweed blows up. But I'm seeing deer food galore that they didn't have to pay for other than the labor to spray. Just buku's amount of deer forage. Being that this is probably got some crop country, I'm surprised I'm not seeing mare's tail or horseweed.
See some very, like, on the very border of the picture down low.
Gotcha. So
mare's tail down.
Another native species that deer browse. Depending on the location of the country, you're going to probably, if you got crops around and you're doing old field stuff, you're probably going to see some of the weeds that farmers hate and curse and hate some more. You're probably going to see some of them show up, which we have to first identify, is this a native or non-native? And if it's a native, we're going to have to look at it with a different lens and say, not sure why I hate this, but let me just look at you. Let me take a good look at you, as Earl Bassmaster says. And so I would definitely, or Ed Bassmaster says, with some of these natives that are going to come up, like common ragweed gets hated by a lot of people. This is pretty stinking beautiful. On a scale of 1 to 10 for forage standpoint, I'm giving it at least a 7, if not an 8. Maybe even the reason I don't give it a 9 is there's probably not a lot of woody browse out here for winter forage and spring. But during the, from pretty well February, sometime in February, you're going to start seeing some green stuff, especially out of the biennials, that may be coming in here in a few years. But at least by late March, early April, forage all the way till the first major frost, very readily available in this area.
Yeah, and that's the thing of, okay, at this site, it at the moment, it's lacking that woody structure. But what I do like to see, you mentioned a lot of the food aspects of it, is I like to see the different height structures of the individual plants out there. In comparison to the photo number one, everything was really about the same level height-wise as buckbrush, and smooth brome was about 18 to 24 inches tall across that whole site. Yeah. In this photo, you can see different plant structures from like umbrella type plants. Then you see some plants that are more erect. They're just dead straight up and they have like opposite leaves. And so you're seeing old growth, new growth, and then new growth is at different stages, different heights. And so that's just breaking up from an animal standpoint, from a wild game standpoint, outlined, it's casting shade. It's leaving some things in the sun. And so I love it from that diversity of structure standpoint. But like you said, they nailed it on the food. And when I say they nailed it, man, they got very fortunate with what's coming back year one. And so it's fantastic to see that response. Even in this site, quite frankly, you've worked another property, a couple miles from this one, And there's a heavy invasive load. And so to see this response so far is very encouraging. And they know to stay aware of any non-native invasive species encroaching to these fields. They know to stay on it from an herbicide standpoint. And then if they need to, continue using fire to eradicate those non-natives. So this site, awesome. The only suggestion I would have is to go in and add in the shrubs, cut down some trees, bring some woody structure out into these units to just get add in that diversity, that component that would be naturally forming. Again, this is year or let's say month number four of implementing this. So far, man, it's looking awesome. And this is where we mentioned earlier, those details matter. And you look across this one and you see lots and lots of green, or maybe to the untrained eye, all you see is weeds, and you wouldn't know that this is far better and drastically exceeds photo number one. But it does in many different categories. Well, I guess all the categories that we're talking about in through this This Does Not Equal That podcast. I
guarantee you there's way more insects around this.
By far.
Way more life. I think, you know, some people may not see it for what it is because their eyes are closed the whole time because they're sneezing constantly just thinking about the amount of ragweed. But this is just, I mean – if you, like you said, you add the woody structures, you plant the shrubs, you maybe get a few more bramble patches mixed in, that's where we can take this from a 70 managed with 80 grit management, incorporate 220 grit, and get it to a 9 because we have that almost year-round forage. And to key it in on species management, if this had been burned, I would rank it a very high 9.5 for brood rearing.
Oh, yeah.
Waited 2 years, and I started getting more perennial encroachment, a little bit thicker herbaceous plants and grasses, maybe even throw in a few shrubby pockets or forest regeneration pockets or stump sprouts. I'd say this is an 8 or 9 in nesting cover, not quite as good brood rearing cover. But I know that by year 4, it's going to get a fire, and it's going to be knocked back. And it's going to be more brood rearing. We've said this before, and we're going to start reiterating it over and over and over again, that you can go from brood rearing to nesting just from your timing of burning. Now, think about it from a deer standpoint. If it's brood rearing habitat for turkeys, it's high quality summer forage for deer because it's more of a herbaceous plant community like ragweed, like mare's tail, like pokeweed, like early young regrowth of American blackberry. But then from the third year burn cycle, where what we're saying is quality nesting cover for turkeys, it's more of a woody browse late winter, early spring forage and deer bedding for the deer, obviously. So you can kind of have two main species that so many people manage for kind of bouncing around from parts of the farm to other parts based on their needs during that time of the year.
And what's really cool about this site is the ability, one, they've got a plan that now breaks out, it's at 150 or so of acres that look like this now of old field across this farm. They got so many different burn units that they can have this continual rotation of, 2 to 3 year burn rotations on different units. So they always have nesting available. They always have brood rearing cover readily available. But what's also neat is that a lot of these rooftops, they have these coves and these fingers or these hardwood drains that kind of cut up to the center of the ridgetop. And so from a woody structure standpoint, if they're going to go in and add that, or simply cut down treetops and drag them out there, we know that deer really associate bedding close to that woody structure. So that's going to go back into the cove-type areas so that a lot of the ridgetop plots or ag fields that are still remain on this property, that they can be accessed on foot. And again, where the woody structure is where deer are going to likely be bedding. And so that's going to still allow them to access and move throughout this farm. Even when deer are utilizing the old field, it's going to be 5, 6, 7 foot tall in some areas. But most of the bedding is going to be tucked back against or in those coves, a little bit more protected. And so, you know, from a hunting standpoint, even though some of the ridge tops look like this or will be much taller come October, November, where it's not the key place where deer are going to be bedding. So that's going to be more off to the edges.
Yeah, all that man, I just did some quick math. You said 150 acres like this.
Yeah.
Roughly 150 acres of this old field, it would take 105 acres of food plots to equal the same amount if you're going based on averages from the University of Tennessee research. So old field managed with fire, about 3,000 to 3,500 pounds of forage. Would you agree with that based on the research?
Yeah.
And then you throw in a food plot where, you know, depending on what you plant, let's just hope you get 5,000 pounds produced per acre. It's going to take about 105. And obviously you're thinking, well, it takes more acres of this to equal that food. Well, this doesn't cost you anything other than time. If you planted 105, let's just say some of that same research or same, you know, Dr. Craig Harper's team.
$300 an acre to plant food plots.
Yeah. That's over $30,000 to get 100+ acres. So not happening for me.
My wallet ain't that thick. I can guarantee that.
I'll lean more on old field. So, you know, I think if this is 80 grit at its finest, like, man, this would be beautiful. If you incorporate some edge feathering, plant the shrubs, drag some treetops, then we're getting into something absolutely amazing.
You can mow a couple trails out into some of your food plots, pass blinds, do that number in addition to just, again, those fine little details, 220 it. And man, this right here is well on its way to being phenomenal wildlife habitat. And to me, an amazing use of the open space.
No doubt.
You're not going to have any other form of management that's going to produce the cover or the forage naturally on this site. This is it. Like, this is just the best that it could be, unless you want to go super, super crazy and supplement everything else. But this right here is where it's going to be. Old field management.
This is phenomenal summer right here. Probably not as wonderful during the winter months. It's not as wonderful. It's better cover. There is going to be some browse, but nothing comparing to summertime browse here. But that's why you also have to supplement or build upon this and go into your forest and get lots of forest regeneration and woody browse available to where you can have just year-round food on the property.
Absolutely. So this does not equal photo number one. Photo number one definitely does not equal photo number two. Hopefully everyone can see those two differences. Train your eyes, train your brain to know what the plants that are growing out there are. Green does not just mean good. It just means something's growing. But it's important to know what is growing. As we can see, the definite differences both in food and coverage, structure and composition between these two sites. And it was just a small amount of time, honestly, to change one to the other, and not a large amount of or heavy investment to make it happen. Everyone sprays their food plots, so we can spray out cool season grasses and accomplish something similar to this on your own place.
Yeah, I hope everybody's enjoying this series. I know we're going to be doing it for a lot because we had good feedback on the last one. So you know, I think trying to go into 2021 with more visual references in our work so people can understand more and more about what the goal actually is. And anyway, guys, I hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you next week.
See you guys.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.